Did you need something to drink?
It might help.
What do you want? If you could tap
anything. If you could have anything in the world, Eric, what drink would it be?
Mountain Dew.
Mountain Dew.
Well, how about that?
A 2 liter.
Let's hope this doesn't destroy the studio.
Yeah. So, how long have you had that 2 liter, Josh?
So basically, over the summer, I went to get some fried chicken on a road trip at a grocery store. And they were like, hey, NASCAR Sunday, you can get some corn chips and a free 2 liter of Mountain Dew.
Nice.
With 12 pieces of roasted chicken.
Thank you.
And I thought, I don't drink Mountain Dew.
You know someone who does.
But I know somebody who does. And
it's even cold.
It is.
Faculty okay. Lounge.
I do love it with all my heart.
It's the first time I've done the Dew.
Cheers.
Well, welcome to Forward, a TEDS faculty podcast. I'm your host, Michelle Knight.
And I'm Josh Chip.
And we are really excited today. We have the pleasure of hosting Dr. Eric Tully, who is director of the PhD of Theological Studies here at TEDS, as well as associate professor of Old Testament and Semitic languages. But perhaps most importantly, he is one of the few faculty members with whom I can talk about sci-fi. This is one of my favorite things about Eric.
I think we've done this before.
We have done this with David Louie, but he was one of the only other few faculty members. But we thought just to warm up a little bit, we would start out with some Star Wars trivia for
okay.
you. Are you ready?
I'm just here for the ride.
Okay, let's do it.
Only 3 questions, and I can't cover the gamut, obviously. So I'm starting out with one really easy one. The second one then is kind of like a boundary defining question where we find out what kind of a fan you are. And the third one is just really on brand. Okay. Here we go. Number one, easy softball. What is the name of the pit creature on Tatooine to whom Luke, Han, and Chewie were supposed to be fed?
Sarlacc.
Thank you. Sarlacc yes. pit.
Did you know the answer?
No,
to that?
I didn't know that. No.
It's my
what
son has a whole.
What episode is that one in?
That's the return of the
That's
Jedi.
An episode 6.
Episode 6. Okay.
Didn't Which know used it. To be episode 3. It's a lot for us.
I was going to say Jabba the Hutt.
He's on Tatooine, so that's something.
Got lucky there. All right.
Cool. All right. In the Mos Eisley showdown between Greedo and Han Solo, who shot first and why does it matter?
Han Solo shot first.
Thank goodness. Tell us why it matters, Eric. I'm not sure that this guy knows.
It matters for the characterization.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Straight to biblical literary sorts of...
That's right. It's okay. One of the first times we meet Han Solo. We need to know right off the bat that he's rogue, mm-hmm. that he means mm-hmm. business, that he gets the job done.
Yeah.
You don't mess with him. And so that change, you know, I think it damaged the character.
Gosh, ooh. Do you know how this changed? Have we complained about this before?
No, I don't know.
When the original 3 movies were re-released, they changed the order. So Greedo shot first.
Okay, instead. I vaguely remember that.
We,
a little bit of fancy camera tricks there.
Oh, and you didn't know that back in the 80s.
Well,
when it was
no, they changed it.
They changed it. Han Solo did shoot first,
okay.
And they changed it to make him more likable.
That doesn't seem right.
They needed to make it like a defensive maneuver.
Okay.
Isn't mm-hmm. that terrible?
That doesn't seem right.
But we obviously agree. Okay, good. This is good. This is helpful. This tells us something about you, Eric. Thirdly, this is my favorite question. The writing on Darth Vader's chest plate resembles which ancient language?
I don't know.
You don't know this?
I don't know.
Okay, so on Darth Vader's chest plate, it's Hebrew.
I have never noticed that before. So, I thought there were dials and lights.
There are, but among them are actually, it's all of the ancient Sith font. Whenever you see it, it's like upside down Hebrew characters in like this really funky format.
I never noticed that before.
People try to claim like there are Reddit forums and subforums and whatevers and subreddits all about this, but it's Hebrew font.
Did you watch our episode with David Louie?
We were
the hosts of that one as well.
I did not watch it.
So
I've
it was
been listening.
Obviously awesome.
You didn't watch it.
And no, I didn't watch the video.
The video. Okay. But yep. You listen, you know that
yes.
She also did Star Trek.
Yes.
Okay. And did you see how David did?
Yes, Michelle won.
She won.
It wasn't actually a competition.
That's where I'm going with this. I think the point of these is basically for someone to show her superiority in terms of all things sci-fi. All right.
Wait. Let's get a couple things
straight.
That's
why you picked the third one. You knew there was no way.
First of all, I did not design the Star Trek trivia. That was totally your idea. And second of all, I was not quizzed in this exchange. So I think that this is a figment of
I don't remember it going down that way, but
well,
maybe.
Anyhow. All right. Well, at this point, Eric has done a great job showing us that he is, in fact, the right kind of sci-fi fan. Have you seen Dune yet, by the way?
I have not.
Okay. No, we might have to follow up about that later, but
maybe
we should probably
faculty
give
retreat
you
material.
I've been reading that book.
Have you?
And I'm about halfway through, and it's been really, really good so far.
Oh, good. Right. I'm getting mixed reviews about the book from people who hadn't read it previously.
Yeah, it's been really interesting.
Good. Should we keep talking about sci-fi or should we make a transition
yes,
at this point?
Yes, we can make a transition. Well, why don't we always kind of start out by having a guest tell us a little bit about your story. So we want to know how you ended up here at TEDS, how you ended up studying what you're studying, doing what you're doing. So you can kind of frame that however you want.
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks very much for inviting me. And yeah, it's really good to be here with you. I actually think, I don't know, maybe it's a cliche to go way back to the beginning, but I actually think that I can trace my journey back to probably first and second grade.
Really?
I was living in Central Africa on the mission field. My parents were missionaries. And I was homeschooled by my mom. My sister and I were the only ones in our little village that did not go to boarding school. So we were homeschooled by my mom, and every day we would have a Bible time, and my mom would get out flannel graphs. So are you guys familiar with flannel graphs?
Oh, yeah.
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 Kind of old school. And my mom was just, she's godly, she's passionate, she speaks with conviction, and she would teach us these Bible stories when I was like in first and second grade. And it just captured my imagination. And I just loved that aspect of the Old Testament, the stories, the various ways that God interacted with his people. So I actually view that as sort of the first little event that got me interested in Old Testament. I'll just tell this little bit of trivia here, which is a little bit off topic.
No,
but we were living in this small mission station with a handful of other Western missionaries, and there was obviously no internet. There was no television. There was no radio. Mm-hmm. There were no stores of any kind. And so we were pretty isolated. There was one TV and VCR on the mission station with a box of about 20 VHS tapes, and we would rotate, and we would get that TV and VCR combination for 1 month out of the year.
Okay.
And so when it was your turn to have the TV and VCR, you just watched and watched
and
watched.
Non-stop movies.
That was your lunch.
20 of these VHS.
And one of the VHS tapes was some Spider-Man cartoons. And one of the VHS tapes was a movie about a girl who wanted to become a pilot. And one of them was Star Wars: A New Hope. And
this
so
explains so much.
It does. It does. Because
awesome.
Every single day after school, I watched that movie.
Wow.
Until I basically had it memorized. So There are multiple aspects of my personality probably arose during that time, but one of them was my love for the stories of the Bible and the Old Testament that came from my mom. When That's we came own. Back from the mission field, it was really tough. It was a really hard adjustment. In some ways, it was like I was immigrating to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. This was a very foreign culture to me, and I felt like I had to try and get up to speed as quickly as I could. It was a really hard experience. And during that time, as I looked to the Bible for sort of ways to think about my faith and to process what had happened to me and to struggle through some of those issues, I really appreciated the Old Testament, the Psalms, the prophets. I mean, as a middle schooler in seventh and eighth grade, ninth grade, 10th grade, I really resonated with, prophets like Jeremiah or Habakkuk, who were even expressing some negative emotion toward God about some of the circumstances that they had gone through, things like that. But at the same time, I was part of a denomination In some ways, the way that they were sort of built theologically, they didn't do much with the Old Testament. And so on the one hand, I felt like I loved the Old Testament. Like I knew how important it was for me for my spiritual life, but I also didn't really have the resources to understand it.
Sure.
In a more sophisticated way. And so I think that was a pretty important piece too, of saying, I want to go to seminary. I want to go to Bible school. And maybe someday I'll get a PhD and, hopefully be a resource to other people who will understand this. And I actually think that's part of the reason why I focus now on the prophets.
Okay.
Because, I do think that they're difficult. I think they're difficult, for church leaders.
Yeah.
And, so I'd like to be a part of the solution to helping pastors and teachers, be able to understand the message of the prophets and see the relevance for today.
Yeah. So growing up as a missionary kid, obviously it sounds like you think about it quite frequently in terms of your vocation or how you are, who you are and what you teach and what you love. And
It was such a long time ago.
Yeah.
And sometimes I wonder why it was so formative, but it was, it was very formative. So, you know, I sometimes think about the analogy of like Christopher Nolan's Inception, where when you're young, if you map sort of the dream world onto real life, it's like when you're young, things happen to you or you go through experiences that have a disproportionate effect on you.
Right.
And because you sort of extrapolate them as you get older, you know? And so it was 8 years of my life. But I think because of the age that I was, maybe because of the way that I'm wired, it did have a pretty significant impact on who I am.
Yeah. That's great.
Cool.
I remember it must have been about 10 or 11 years ago. We both started at the same time and we were getting our faculty orientation. And I'm still just a lowly New Testament professor, but now you've had a little bit of a role switch in terms of, is this your second year directing?
It is, yeah.
So you direct the theological studies program at the academic doctoral office. We all get questions about why is a PhD important? Is this something that God might be calling me to? I'd love to hear a little bit about what you tell students when they ask you questions about, is this a good fit? Is it worth sacrificing so many years and so much work? Mm-hmm. What might you say to students that are kind of wrestling with whether this is something that God might be calling them to?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's hard. I think it's a little bit difficult to answer that in the abstract.
Totally, yeah.
Because
yeah.
it depends
yeah.
so much on who you are yeah. and how you're wired and things like that. But I think that I do think that a PhD probably isn't for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
It does require a significant commitment, not only from you, but from if you're married or if you have children, the whole family is along for the ride on this commitment and it can be substantial. But I do think that a PhD can be valuable for service and God's kingdom work in much broader ways than we sometimes think. I think sometimes mm-hmm. we think that you get a PhD yeah. and then you go into academic teaching.
Yeah.
And I think that, I think that the most important part of getting a PhD is not actually the content that you learn, but learning how to think, how to research, mm-hmm. how to make an argument with precision. And those kinds of aspects or elements of your training can really serve you well in a wide variety of circumstances. So mm-hmm. in our PhD program, you know, it's... One of our distinctives is theological integration. So we're not just interested in sort of boiling a particular concentration or discipline down to its most rudimentary parts, but we're interested in interdisciplinary dialogue and working in that field from the perspective of a high view of scripture and theological conviction and things like that. And so we have a number of students who come get a PhD in a particular research area, and then that serves them really well for pastoral ministry.
Right. Yeah.
In recent years, we've had a number of graduates who have done excellent doctoral work, but now they're flourishing as pastors in a local church, and that church is benefiting from their careful thinking and their good preaching and their research ability and things like that.
So, yeah.
I think there's a wide range of benefits to getting that kind of intense training.
I often say something similar, I think, in terms of if you have a, like, I'm going to go get this tenure track position, then you might be set up for something that's really difficult. But if you're going in thinking about, this is the kind of person that I want to be, and I'm open to the ways in which God might use this in a wide variety of different circumstances, then, and you love it, right? Then it's sort of like, all right, then maybe to keep asking some, you know, questions. But
I got my PhD in a secular environment. It was mostly devoid of any theological inquiry. But I do think that it has made me a better preacher. It's made me better at a lot of things that I do, even in church ministry, because so much of it is just about a kind of rigor in the ways that you process things. And so I think there can be, real benefit to advanced training like that.
Yeah.
One of the things I think back on most frequently in my doctoral training is how good I got at actually listening to what someone was saying in an argument, because I do think that in earlier attempts at research, it would have been pretty easy to just kind of pull out certain points somebody's making, to either support my point or not. But I do think that at that doctoral level, we really learn to see somebody as like who has an integrated view of the world, who's making a particular argument for a particular reason, and we are kind of better equipped to handle it and read them well and enter a conversation rather than just kind of using people for their quotations. Do you guys remember like when I learned to write a research paper, I was actually trained to like write quotations on like three by five cards and like move them around and organize a paper. And I do feel like with my doctoral students, like my work or master students is unlearning that. Like, let's engage real arguments, not straw men we construct from 3x5 cards. But anyhow. Well, you've talked quite a bit about your role here at Trinity, but I'd love to hear a little bit more about the prophets. You've already said that that has been a significant part of your research lately. You've been working on the Baker textbook, reading Christian scripture, and that'll be about the prophets. And if I recall, that's coming out in 2022, right?
It is, in March.
Yeah.
Wow.
So you've been deep in the prophets. You recently published on Hosea with Baylor. And then are you working on an Ezekiel commentary too? Mm-hmm. Is that right?
That's my current project.
Okay. So you're deep in. But one of the classes you teach here that was really well attended was on the Book of the Twelve, which if you're not familiar with that term, listeners, that is the Minor Prophets. Can you talk to us a little bit about what it means to be studying the Book of the Twelve? And what that means, especially in relation to what normally we call the Minor Prophets in English Protestant circles.
That class, it was on the composition of the Book of the Twelve. It was a particular question that we were engaging with. It was a doctoral class. And it was really about that question of what constitutes a book and how do we know that... How do we view the ways that the various prophets relate to each other? So that was the question. I think when we talk about the minor prophets, that label usually implies that there are 12 individual prophets. I don't love that label because the word minor can have connotations of lesser importance or something like that.
Sure.
And it is true. They're much, much shorter than Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel. The minor prophets tend to have a much sharper focus on one issue that is carried out, even in a book like Micah, which is quite a bit longer. You have the theme of remnant. Amos is interested in horizontal aspects of covenant obligations like social justice and Obadiah is interested in Edom as kind of a token or a prototype for the nations in the day of the Lord. So I do think that the prophets, the minor prophets, do tend to focus on one particular issue. Most of them are associated with a particular time period, a particular historical context. There's a bit of biography included internally on some of those prophets. So usually when we use the word minor prophet, we're talking about a collection of the shorter prophetic books of the Old Testament. When we use the word, the label Book of the Twelve, I think typically that assumes that the 12 minor prophets are actually intended to be read as one book.
Yeah.
So that's the difference. And there's different ways you can think about that. You can think about the 12 prophets as a book simply in the sense that they all were written together on one scroll. So maybe they were literally a book.
Yeah.
Because that's about the size of one scroll. And we have very early statements, you know, going all the way back to Sirach in 200 BC about the 12 prophets as one unit. Josephus and other ancient writers talk about 22 books of the Old Testament, which would assume that the 12 are considered as one, things like that. So that's one possibility. It's one literal book. A second possibility is that it's an anthology. So the prophets all relate thematically to each other to a greater degree. So for example, the theme of the day of the Lord is very important in the minor prophets or in the Book of the 12 that you don't get in Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel. I would say also the theme of Israel's relationship to the nations is probably a particularly important theme in those books. A third way that you can talk about the Book of the 12 is that it was actually not just an anthology of 12 separate books that were written on one scroll together, but it was they were actually edited together and intentionally shaped. So, for example, James Nagalsky is well known for this view that the ending of one book corresponds to the beginning of the next. He calls these like catchwords or catchphrases, showing that editors or scribes have particularly, you know, rewritten parts of these books in order to link the different books together. And then some scholars would even say that that a book like Joel was not even an original prophetic book, but it was written for incorporation into this book. In other words, there was no Joel with an original historical prophetic ministry, but it was a literary work that was in order to make it 12 and in order to sort of tie the books together and things like that. I don't personally find that third option as convincing. And I actually think that it works a bit against the internal claims of the books about when it comes to historical context and things like that.
Sure. But
yeah. So usually when we're talking about the Book of the 12, we're talking about the degree to which these 12 books form one big book.
Yeah.
That has either thematic or literary or even a sort of a compositional coherence.
Do they sometimes almost, do they demonstrate like the individual prophets' knowledge of each other? I mean, in terms of, I guess that's maybe hard to like establish definitively, but in terms of basically like intratextual allusions to each other. And if so, like, how do you, where does that come from?
Right. Yeah. And that's a good question. I'm not, you'd have to take it on a case by case basis.
Okay.
But I think that would be a part of the
third option.
That'd be a part of the question. So for the so-called grace formula, which is that God is gracious and compassionate, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love. That grace formula is seen throughout the 12 prophets. And so you could take the view that it's a very significant creedal or faith expression in the Old Testament, and therefore they all just simply happen to use it.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could see that that's evidence that there's been some editing that's taken place there.
Yeah.
One particularly interesting case of that is the correspondence between Jonah and Joel, where in the book of Jonah, Jonah's angry that God is gracious and compassionate, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and relenting over harm because he showed grace to the Ninevites. In the book of Joel, the prophet says to Israel, you should repent because you know that God will show grace to you because he's gracious and compassionate. So only those two expressions have the complete grace formula and this last bit of information, which is relenting over harm.
Yeah.
So there seems to be some sort of an intertextual link there, an intentional link. And you could say that that's a scribe editing the book of the 12 together. I tend to think, I guess if I had to pick, I would say that Joel is late and is actually borrowing from Jonah and showing that, showing Israel, if God is this gracious to pagan Ninevites, then certainly you can expect him to show you mercy when you
repent.
So,
yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, but there's some interesting questions there about the relationship between the books.
Well, and you've spoken of kind of the compositional question historically, but I guess what I'm wondering is, can you give us an example? I mean, obviously you don't have to pick side right now, but can you give us an example of the effect that this might have on interpreting these books? So like, let's say that the Book of the 12 was written to be considered one book. With these intentional intertextual links, you've already given us one example of how if we read Joel and Jonah together, that might kind of up the ante in Joel a little bit. But can you help us see how considering these questions could actually affect interpretation in a couple other cases?
Yeah, it's always a question. I mean, interpretation is always related to the position of a particular passage in its context. And so the question here is... what is the contextual relationship of one passage and one prophet to another one? Is it simply that they happen to be not only in the same canon, but in the same corpus?
Yeah.
Or is it closer than that? Is that some editorial hand has actually intended for us to read these passages in light of each other in a much more intentional way?
Yeah.
Because it's part of the same literary context. Mm-hmm. So that would be the... That would be the major question.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because some commentaries have come out recently where the author will say, I fully accept the Book of the 12 as one edited book, but I'm still going to interpret these prophets individually.
Oh, how interesting.
So despite the current state of the question on that more broadly, which again, I personally don't find as convincing. There still seems to be a pretty strong pull toward individual. There's still a recognition that each of these books has a particular voice.
Yeah.
That has not been completely subsumed under one.
That's interesting.
One book.
So. That's very interesting.
It reminds me of, I won't name names, but a couple that will say, you know, 2 Thessalonians, it's pseudonymous. But none of the reasons that have been given for its pseudonymity are really that convincing anymore, but I'm still just going to treat it as if it's pseudonymous. You know, you're sort of like, well, what are you even doing the work for? Anyway, just kind of quickly, but I'd love to hear, you know, we've got Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and these big major prophets. Is there, and I'm sure there's a lot of different themes. You've already mentioned a couple of them, interesting examples when you're talking about, Obadiah and others, but is there one theme that you'd say we'd really be missing, like in our canon, if we only had those major prophets, and like there would just be like a significant lack, whether it's canonically or it's maybe even something that you find important or relevant for, you know, faith in the 21st century from the minor prophets?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. I think the combination of the two themes that I think are maybe the most prominent in the minor prophets, which is the day of the Lord and the non-Israelite nations, that is a very significant theological piece.
Yeah.
And one of the things I think that the minor prophets really contribute to our theology is this idea that when we think about the eschaton or in the end, God breaking into human history and setting all things right. That could either be good or bad news, depending on how you relate to God. Mm. When I was young, I was in a theological tradition that always talked about eschatology in really scary ways. And I think we were all sort of worried about the coming day of the Lord, right? We were always nervous about, is this the end times? And I remember as a teenager, just always hoping that God would not return in my lifetime, just always worrying about what's that going to mean when the world is upended by the return of Christ. And I think one of the things that's been very personally edifying for me in the Minor Prophets has been a complete 180 on that, and understanding that if you are properly related to God through his covenant, which we now in the New Testament know is through Christ, that there's nothing to worry about, that God has everything under control. And for those who are properly related to the Lord because they have accepted his salvation, the day of the Lord is something to anticipate. Evil will be put down. God will claim his people as his own. There will be no more oppression, and the world will be set right. And for those who are not properly related to God, then you could pick an example like the book of Amos, which says there's really nothing good to look forward to.
Oh.
So an example of that might be the book of Zephaniah, which I think is probably the book in the Bible that is most clear about this idea that the coming day of the Lord and God's eschatological breaking into history is either the best news that there could ever be or the worst news, and it's kind of up to you. And that was very helpful to me. And so now I think as an adult, having had the chance to process these kinds of things, I think with John at the end of Revelation, I think now I can fully long for God's coming. Not be concerned about it anymore. So that's sort of one practical way that's affected.
No, that's awesome.
Thanks, Eric.
Well, if we could shift away from Zephaniah to Hosea, that was the volume you spent some time on for Baylor. What's interesting about that commentary, if I can even call it that, is it's only barely a commentary. It's part of Baylor's handbook series, which really is kind of like a linguistic analysis of the book. Can you talk to us a little bit about why that kind of work is valuable? And I don't just mean kind of in a broadly academic sense, but especially for people who are part of the TEDS community who care about the global church. We're trying to serve this church and strengthen the church. How does that kind of work lead to a stronger, more capable church?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of different kinds of commentaries. In some ways, I think that the work that is done in those Baylor handbooks is sort of a traditional commentary. It's in some ways, it's almost a pure commentary because it is analysis and explanation of the text itself. It's true. It doesn't really contain overt theology. It doesn't deal very much with historical background and things like that. Sometimes commentaries can just get more and more bloated with, you know, and they become repositories for everything that you could possibly say about the text. But you're right. It is very limited in its focus, and it focuses on the Hebrew text, syntax, you know, how the relationship of the words to each other, impacts meaning. I talk a lot in there about the semantics of individual words and why this word was chosen instead of a different one and the nuances that that might have. Hosea in particular has a lot of difficulties. It's interesting when in my Latter Prophets course for the MDiv students, I assign a number of different prophetic passages for them to work through in Hebrew. And, it is interesting to hear the comments about Hosea, the Hosea passage, because they just always say, what is going on here? You know, it's so difficult. And it's an interesting book because you understand what all the words mean individually, but when you put them together, it's not always easy to make sense of.
Totally.
And so there's been some debate. Is that because he was the only northern prophet and it's dialect, or is it because the book has just suffered in transmission and has become corrupted in some way? So there's different views on that. But so basically, this Baylor handbook is an opportunity to explain the text and say there's a variety of ways that you could take this particular clause or this particular sentence, and as you weigh the evidence and look at what others have done and I have some fresh contributions in there as well. It's an explanation of what this says. So I think it doesn't, I think it'd be difficult to make the sense that it, you know, directly serves the church, but it, it's upstream of that because it, in some ways it's, I think intended to, help perhaps pastors who are working through the text, preaching sermons.
Yeah.
It's intended to help scholars who maybe are writing a commentary on Hosea to have a resource for what's going on in the Hebrew text, provide some analysis on that. So it was a really enjoyable book to work on. I also wrote my dissertation on Hosea and did a lot with the Hebrew text and ancient translations. And so this kind of flowed out of that and it was an opportunity to... Mm-hmm. To put all that together.
I adore those handbooks, partially because of some of the things you talked about in terms of kind of commentary bloat. I mean, we've all written commentaries and are writing commentaries, so obviously we think they're valuable.
I haven't finished one, so mine's not bloated yet.
I certainly have not finished one very early in my progress. But I do think it's helpful for students to kind of just like cut out the noise. And it's like, let's just make sure we understand what's happening with the Hebrew text. And then it provides the backbone for like really imaginative, like... And I'm not suggesting that people should just like make stuff up, but if we read certain kinds of commentaries only, it's like those are the only conversations we have about the text. But what the handbook does is reminds us just like what the text is saying and gives us opportunity to ask questions that maybe haven't been asked before, just because we're not kind of getting stuck in some of those conversations. So I really do think it encourages us to really think about this text and contextualize it for our congregations or for the problems the churches are facing. And so I'm really glad that you contributed to that. I think it's a great series.
I use the New Testament ones, obviously, more than the Old Testament. But now I'm kind of motivated. Don't read the Old Testament. I want to be like, I want to read Hosea in Hebrew.
And you can, though, because you have an excellent tool that's going to help you through all of that syntactical nonsense.
We're probably getting close to being out of time. But I did just want to ask one more question. You and David Louis, I don't know if you still will, but you have team taught a course on the Psalms.
Yeah.
And David Louis is a theologian, so he's got his own, you know, kind of particular training and bent. Obviously, you do Old Testament. If you could only pick one, what is the thing that you think is like most fundamentally wrong about David Louis' approach?
And listeners, if you want to hear David Louis' side, please go back to our archives. We gave them each a chance.
Yeah, no, just answer it in terms of where are there places where you find like interesting convergence and divergence from each other?
Yeah, it is. It's an important conversation that we're having about hermeneutics and the role of theology and exegesis and things like that. I mean, I've really appreciated the opportunity to teach that class with him, and I hope we will have the opportunity to do that again. I think we're probably closer than maybe it seems at times, but I think that the things that David and I each emphasize have to do with our concerns about potential abuses.
Mm. That makes sense.
So I think he's concerned, and rightly so, about an interpretive approach that is just completely stuck in the historical details, does not quickly enough move to theology, and ignores the place of that text in the canon, and perhaps doesn't make any room at all for the divine author. I think the abuse that I'm concerned about is a kind of canonical flattening that doesn't take into account progressive revelation, that assumes that we can read backward or forward however we want, and that makes so much of the role of the divine author in the communication that we're finding things in the text that maybe the author meant but didn't say. Mm. And I would say that those would be some of my concerns.
Great. Yeah,
so he's interested, David is interested from his perspective in systematic theology of exploring the canonical, sort of the canonical pressure that is put upon a text. I probably, I do certainly start with the starting point that, I want to look at the particular contribution that that passage makes and then move outward from there to see what the implications are in the rest of the canon. So helpful. One interesting, you know, way that that manifested itself is that question about the relationship between the divine author and the human author.
Right.
And I think my training is to look for the human author, right? Yeah. What is the human author saying? And then my evangelical convictions tell me that is being superintended by the divine author.
Yeah.
And I think David's sort of systemic view is to allow for the human author, but to primarily think about what the divine author is doing this with foreknowledge and things like that.
Totally.
So that would definitely be maybe one of the starting points. I remember probably one of our more significant charitable conflicts was when I made the point that I think that what the divine author communicates and what the human author communicates completely correspond. If you were to make a Venn diagram, I think that whatever the divine author has said is sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's all he said, that's all he said. I don't need to read between the lines or I don't think David liked that very much.
So. I can imagine. That's perfect.
That's great.
I'm glad students get to hear both and see you guys enter that conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I like to think that it's a microcosm of what we are at TEDS. Mm-hmm. I just think it's an extremely healthy place of all of us on faculty and students as well, having really strong convictions about things, but being charitable toward each other and learning from each other.
Yeah.
And so it's very healthy.
Within certain parameters of agreed upon and shared convictions.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So
I love that.
I really appreciate that.
Yeah. Cool. And that's just the foreword. Be sure to check out Eric Tully's work forthcoming with Baker Academic Press on the prophets. You can find his handbook, his commentary on Hosea, published with Baylor University Press. Other works, his textual criticism book with Baker, and there's more in the works. So we want to thank you so much for spending time with us, Eric. We also want to thank our wonderful producer, Curtis Pierce. We're grateful for our wonderful graduate assistant, Lauren Januzik.
We are.
And that's it. That's just the foreword. I'm Josh Jip.
And I'm Michelle Knight.
Forward is a podcast hosted by faculty at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. The views expressed by the hosts and guests of Forward do not necessarily represent the views of Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. You can subscribe to our newest episode on your preferred podcast app or at forwardpodcast.com. Be sure to follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Forward Podcast to get updates and additional links to content. Trinity Evangelical Divinity School is located 25 miles north of Chicago, with extension sites across the country and online. Trinity educates men and women to engage in God's redemptive work in the world by cultivating academic excellence, Christian faithfulness, and lifelong learning. You can find more information at teds.edu.